Okay, so it's winter here in the Northern Hemisphere, for those of us who don't live in Florida. And it's cold. As I record this, I have a heated blanket on, an extra heater running, and it is minus 14 outside. Yeah, it's cold. But there are positives to it being winter, and there are things to photograph in the night sky. What are those things? Well, hang tight and let's see.
Hi, I'm Christine Richet, an artist and mentor to photographers around the world. Consider me your interstellar guide on the path to being a better nightscape photographer. In this podcast, we will bring together our artistic right brain and technical left brain by exploring creativity, art, and inspiration in photography, as well as diving into technique, gear, and strategy necessary to elevate your craft and photographic practice. I am so happy to be a part of your Milky Way journey. This is the After Dark Photography Podcast.
Oh, hello and welcome. I'm so happy to have you here. As I mentioned in my little intro bit, yeah, it's winter. If you're listening to this when it's being recorded, it's winter up here in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's cold, and I have a cold too, so my apologies. But this year I have made a list and a plan for the podcast, and cold or no cold, I'm getting it out there. Now, one of the things that I did at the end of last year when I was like, okay, to my head, Christine, you gotta make a plan. If I don't make plans, things tend not to happen. Did you listen to the last episode? It was all about planning, just in case you're wondering. And part of that plan was seeing what people wanted to hear on the podcast. So not only what I want to talk about, but what you want to hear me talk about. And one of the overwhelming things that I got in response was the winter sky. What is there to photograph this time of year while we're waiting for the Milky Way to come back? So that's what this episode is all about. I do apologize. This is very Northern Hemisphere centric. I have not been to the Southern Hemisphere. I've done a fair amount of research on what the Milky Way core looks like, and you all really have to, like, it's like real high up there, especially as we get into June, July, August. It is really high up there. Need some good wide angle lenses or some nice panoramics. But you know what? There's a lot that I really don't know about the experience of photographing the night sky in these months in the Southern Hemisphere, because I've never been there and I'm not as familiar with the different things that can be seen there in the night sky. A lot of it will be the same, but a lot of it will be a little bit different as well, aside from the fact that things are just flipped. So my apologies for if you're listening and you are coming in from down under. Some of this will be relevant, but my biggest recommendation would be to take everything that I talk about and to go look at it in Stellarium. So Stellarium is an amazing free software. Bit of a memory hog, but it's a pretty great program, and it lets you see exactly where and when things are going to be in the sky for your location. If you've never used it before, I'm a big proponent of it. I do have a tutorial video on my YouTube channel, Christine Rose Photography. You can go and check that out, and it will give you exactly what you need to know to get started with searching around and seeing what you can see and where and when. And I will say, this goes for anyone who's listening, if I'm talking about something and you're like, oh, I've never thought of that before, I've never looked for that, where do I look for it? Go and look it up in Stellarium. So put in your location, put in the time and date, and put it into the search box inside of Stellarium, and you will know exactly where and when to look, to the point that people who meet you will be like, oh, are you like an astronomer? You're like, ha, 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 ha. No, I definitely am not. So the first thing to be photographing in the night sky in the winter is the moon. Yes, the moon. You know, I don't do a ton of moon photography, but the moon in the winter, when it is clear, oh, it is amazing. Seeing can be really, really amazing. You can get some really crisp images of the moon on nights when it is actually quite clear. If you are more northern, this is going to be cold as well, but that's the trade-off, isn't it? So this might be a time of year where we spend a little bit more time with the moon, maybe planning out some images where you use a long focal length and you get the moon rising or setting, depending, over a landscape. I personally, if I am going to try and plan for a full moon photo, I either try to plan for the night of the full moon or the night before the full moon. And the reason that I like to do that is because it rises on full moon, it rises right when the sun sets. So there's still a fair amount of light in the foreground, and you can get detail in the moon and get detail in the landscape around it. Same thing the night before, the moon is not quite full, but it is going to be rising up just before sunrise. So there's more light in the ambient landscape, and we don't have to have a really dark landscape in order to not blow out the moon. The problem with one day past full moon is that the moon is rising up after the sun has set. And what does that mean? Not very much ambient light around. And it just ends up being that your foreground is going to be quite, quite dark. Now, this could work for some cityscapes. So if you are able to get farther away from some iconic buildings or landmarks, this can work if those things are lit up. It can also work if those things work as a really nice sort of silhouette. But otherwise, if it's moon over a landscape, it will be too broad of a dynamic range. And I really would recommend trying to get either the night of the full moon or the night before. And I know you're probably hearing this and being like, well, I haven't had any clear night, so I'll take what I can get. There's also that as a consideration. Now, that's going to be the full moon, but think about lots of other compositions and creative ways that we can include the moon in our images. What about if it is a small crescent moon that is just about to hit the horizon? That is quite a different look in an image than a full moon is. And it can be, well, it can be whatever you want it to be, honestly. But let's just think for a moment of maybe a simpler and quieter composition. So one where we have the crescent moon and it's just about to set, let's say in the morning, and it's coming down over a frozen lake. And so you've got a little bit of that reflection. You've got some of the light and the color coming from the sunrise that's about to come up. That in itself can be a really lovely composition and it can be very evocative. So There's lots that we can do. It depends on what you want to do. Do you want the full moon and it is highlighting the tops of snow-covered fir trees with long shadows coming out towards you? Or do you want something that is a little bit more of a softer image? So many different ideas here, but we can play around with this throughout the moon cycle. We just have to pay attention to where the moon is going to be in the night sky. What time is it rising and what time is it setting? Because of course, it's not the same each night. For most of these images I'm talking about, my kind of interest is inclusion of a landscape. If you're going to include the moon plus a landscape, generally it's going to be when it's just rising or when it's just setting. So we want to make sure we know those times. You can find those, again, Stellarium is super useful with that. But even just going to timeanddate.com you can put in your location and you can go to where it has the sun and moon, and it will tell you the times that the moon is rising and the times that the moon is setting each day. And so you can go through and see exactly when and where it's rising and setting. You can also use the same apps that we use for photographing the Milky Way. So PhotoPills, fantastic for moon rises and moon sets. Planet Pro, fantastic for moon rises and moon sets. Okay, moon. Have I sold you on the moon yet? It's pretty wonderful. The moon is pretty wonderful, I have to say. If I have not yet sold you on the moon and you're like, no, I'd like to do something else. Not huge fan of photographing the moon. That's okay. You're welcome here. Let's move on to the next. So when we are talking about off season and photographing something other than the Milky Way, we are looking in kind of two buckets. So one bucket is without tracking. And the other bucket is with tracking. So we'll start without tracking. And if we are going to be pointing our camera lenses at something in the night sky in the off season without tracking, the likelihood is it's going to be Orion. Right now, as I'm recording this in January, when it becomes full dark here in Nova Scotia, I can see Orion already up in the sky. And Orion is coming and setting it's in between, depending on what time of the month, but it's in between 3 and 4 a.m. is when Orion is coming and setting. So we have Orion up in the night sky for a pretty long time. Given that it's dark here by about 6 o'clock, I think full dark is about 6:30 right now, Orion is up in the sky for quite a while. And Orion continues to be in the night sky through January, February, March into April. So we're able to get out there and follow Orion and take some really cool images of what is a pretty interesting constellation. When we're photographing Orion, we have to think about a few things here. So one, are we going to be shooting closer up to Orion? Do we want to get all of Orion in? Do we want to get Orion plus a landscape in? What is the composition that we're interested in shooting? Because all of this is going to shift when we do it, what we use, and so on. So I will say that when we are photographing Orion rising, when Orion is rising up, Orion is going to be more like, if I can personify the constellation here, more like he's like, oh, I'm tired. I'm just waking up. I'm just going to like lay down on the horizon. Orion is a little bit more horizontal when it rises. And you're going to be able to shoot with, say, a 35 millimeter, maybe a 50 millimeter. You won't get very much landscape, but you get a little bit in the landscape orientation. And get Orion with the horizon and some of the foreground. Now, as Orion wakes up, as Orion rises, Orion starts to stand up and become more of a vertical orientation. Now, this is in the northern hemisphere. Everything is opposite in the southern hemisphere. And is also so much higher up in the sky. So again, I apologize, but definitely check stellarium so you can see exactly what it looks like. But as Orion gets higher in the sky, we need to go with a wider and wider lens. So when Orion is up at its highest point in the sky, depending on where we're at, you might need a 14 millimeter to a 24 millimeter lens in order to get Orion as well as the landscape. You might even need to have a 14 millimeter, and I'm talking on full frame, so if you're on APS-C or micro four thirds, it's going to be even a smaller number, wider angle than that in terms of the actual focal length number. You might need, depending on where you're at and how close to the equator you are, you might even need to do something like a vertical panoramic in order to get Orion and a landscape in. Now, I find myself that Orion can get lost when it's up higher in the sky. There's not as much visually happening in that area of the sky. So it can get a little bit lost. And if there's lots of other stars, especially if it's a beautiful clear night and there's tons of stars, it can be a little bit more difficult. So I prefer not to photograph Orion when it's super high up in the sky. So either I'm going to be photographing it right when it's rising, or I'm going to wait until it's setting. And now that would mean, you know, if I want Orion setting, the sun would be out at like 3 a.m. right now to shoot, which, you know, is not, it's normal. People sometimes are like, you're crazy. And I'm like, ah, maybe a little bit. So I prefer to photograph, again, same thing like I said with the moon. It's like, am I a broken record? I think we're just done now, right? I'm just going to keep saying the same thing. No, I do prefer when it's rising or when it's setting. So that means I'm going to have to pay attention to what time it rises and sets, and where for my location I can see it. So it rises generally in the east and sets in the west, but it's not perfectly east and perfectly west. So it's good to have an idea of those actual directions where it's rising and setting. When we are shooting Orion, if you are shooting with a slightly longer lens, so really I tend to go about 50 millimeters if I'm trying to get any landscape with it, or a 35 millimeter. You can go up and shoot with a 70 millimeter and just get Orion. Your framing has to be pretty bang on. If you really want the main stars to be right at the edge, you could also shoot with an 85. But I also don't like to shoot anything over 50 millimeter on full frame without tracking, because there's just not enough light to get detail and data in the sky. So my go-to is 50 millimeters or under. That's on full frame. And that lets me be able to get enough light, especially because often if we're shooting with a 50 millimeter, it is a prime lens, which fortunately gives us more light with our aperture. And my 35, the 35 that I tend to use is my Sigma Art 35. So that is an f1.4, which is nice as well. What I will say is when we are shooting with these focal lengths, they're longer focal lengths than we traditionally photograph the Milky Way. So I do prefer for these images to be stacked so that we're able to reduce some of the noise and maybe just push the files a little bit, a wee bit more, to get a little bit more of the color out of the night sky in these images. That's my personal preference. Your mileage may vary, of course, but I would recommend, if you can, trying to stack when you're photographing Orion, because you will see quite a difference. The other thing that we can photograph without tracking would be the actual winter arch itself. So just because it's not quote unquote Milky Way season, well, the Milky Way is still there. It just so happens to be the less busy arm of the Milky Way. So if the Milky Way core is like the busy city center, the winter arch, which is the Orion and the Cygnus arms, they're more like a little bit out in the boonies. We're turning away from the city fun-filled Milky Way core, and we're looking a little bit more out to the boonies. That's where Orion lives, but that's okay. He's okay with it. He likes it. It's a nicer pace out there, frankly, just saying. Not so busy, all these things. Who knows what's going on in the Milky Way core. This is to say, I've gone off track a little bit, apologies. This is to say that there's still an arch. There's still the Milky Way. It's still going to look like a river in the sky, or we'll have a band of stars going through the sky. It's just has less detail and less concentration than the core of our home galaxy does. So you can photograph that whole winter arch, and it is really quite stunning. Now, I am saying that there's less data and detail. If you are someone who has an astro-modified camera, so you have a camera that has been modified to see hydrogen alpha, well then, There's a lot of data and detail actually to be seen in the quote unquote winter arm, the Orion and the Cygnus arms that we have coming out. There's a ton of hydrogen alpha. It is a little bit difficult to capture that accurately unless you're also using a hydrogen alpha filter. And that's a little bit of a more complex thing to do. So you would be photographing the whole scene just with your camera, no filter in, and then you would be taking the same images with the hydrogen alpha filter in. So it's only capturing hydrogen alpha detail. And then there's a fair amount of post-processing that goes in to make that actually exist and look the way you want it to. You have likely seen images out there. They're really stunning. They take a long time, a long time. I can tell you, I know from the photographers who I've seen doing it. I say that because I have not taken the time to do it myself. I see the images and I'm like, I know what went into that. I know I could technically do that, but it would take a long time. It would be really cold. I might stay inside. Well, anyways, they are stunning. The images are stunning. I will say most often if you're doing like a full winter arch with hydrogen alpha, they're probably also tracking at that point. You can take a nice arch panoramic without tracking though and without using the hydrogen alpha, and it still can be quite lovely. If you have a fog filter, this is one of the scenarios. So photographing Orion or photographing the winter arch, this is one of the scenarios where I would be breaking out that fog filter. Would I for every single image? No, I would not. But I would do it for some, especially because what happens with a fog filter is it emphasizes the larger and brighter stars and it de-emphasizes the others. So in an image where it's really the constellation of Orion and the bright stars of Orion that are we want to be emphasized, well, that's exactly what the fog filter does. So if you do have one, this could be a really good time to use it. If you don't, and you're in an area where there's going to be condensation, maybe at the end of the night, you take off your lens heater and you let your lens fog up a little bit. You gotta be quick though, because it can't be completely fogged. It can only be a little bit fogged. Okay, so that's without tracking. So photographing just Orion and using probably somewhere in a 35 to 50 millimeter when it's rising or setting, or photographing the winter arch. And you can do the whole arch, you can do just some of it. The whole arch, of course, is doing a panoramic or just using a wide angle and getting just some of it in your image. Then we go to tracking. I really see this kind of off-season as the time to be playing around with my tracker and taking images with my longer lenses and zooming in on cool parts in the night sky. I mean, there's so many cool things in the night sky. It's just insanity. Most of us here, you listening, I'm sure you've heard of NASA APODS, the astronomy photo of the day. Like, just go and click through that. I had NASA APOD as my homepage when I was throughout most of my 20s, and just like every day opening up my computer and looking at it and being like, what is this thing that people have taken pictures of? To think now that I also can take pictures of these things is pretty cool. Full circle moment, I would say. So we don't have the Milky Way core, but there's lots of other really awesome stuff to take photos of. And the first thing, and what I think I can't say is everyone's first, because there's another one on this list that might be, but most people's first target when they get a tracker, or even if they're just using a longer lens, even without a tracker, is the Orion Nebula. It's really cool. It's really, really cool. You can photograph it with a longer lens without tracking and still get some data and detail. You won't get the level with which you can when you start using a tracker, but you'll be able to still get a shot, taking it at only maybe anywhere from 3 to 5 seconds, depending on how long your focal length is. But the Orion Nebula, Orion's up in the sky, so yes, M42, the Orion Nebula is up in the sky, and it is an amazing target to shoot. When I start talking about tracking photographing with longer lenses, there's a lot we can do. I'm going to just talk about four things that I personally would start with. And in terms of lenses and focal lengths, longer is better in some ways because the target is larger in your frame. It's also harder in other ways. As you use a longer and longer focal length, focusing becomes difficult and your actual polar alignment needs to be bang on. Like it has to be really, really good. So we do have this kind of thing like, oh, like I can't do this. I need a super long lens. Well, you don't need a crazy long lens. What a really great lens to start with is the Rokinon 135 millimeter. Now, if you have a fixed 135 millimeter and it's not the Rokinon, go ahead and use that. I'm pretty sure Nikon has a nice 135. Canon probably does too. But I can tell you that the Rokinon 135 millimeter is a lovely lens. It has a hard stop at infinity and it's almost always bang on in terms of focus for the ones that I've used. So I really quite like the Rokinon 135 millimeter. Doesn't cost an arm and a leg and does a fantastic job. That being said, if you have a longer lens, if you have a 70 to 200 millimeter, let's say f2.8, or you have a 200 to 500 or a 300 millimeter lens, all of these lenses are going to be really great for the four targets that I talk about. So my recommendation, if you've never done this before, is to get help from someone. Getting started. I'm actually just running through deep sky targets with my tracking class. We have, I think, one more call. I believe one more call next week. We have one more call to go over any more questions that any of the students are having. And it's really fun to get into their first deep sky targets. I would definitely recommend getting assistance the first time that you're going to try and do deep sky work. People get pretty excited. So if you know someone who has the gear, they probably are more than happy to have you come out and shoot with them. With any of these that we're going to get out and start tracking, I always recommend first just getting used to finding the target, focusing, and actually shooting the target. I personally like to do what are called deepscapes. So we talk about nightscapes being a landscape at night with the night sky. A deepscape is a deep sky object at night rising or setting over a landscape. That's what like lights me up, where I get super excited. They're very time consuming and planning intensive to pull off. And you need to have perfect conditions to do it. So they can be quite difficult, but I get super, super excited at the idea of creating them. And this is really because to me, like, you know, we're used to seeing big moon rising and setting, but we're still not as used to seeing these objects that exist in the night sky that are relatively large rising and setting over a landscape, because we can't actually see them. We can't see them in the same way with our eyes. So I get super, super excited about that. However, I do not recommend that's where you start. Okay. If that is a goal, it's a fantastic goal to have, but don't start there unless you want to get crazy, crazy frustrated. You can take that as a challenge if you want, but I'm more so thinking about your sanity at the moment. Okay, so my top four, and it just so happens all of these are up in the night sky right now, which is wonderful, is the Orion Nebula, the Rosette Nebula, also sometimes called the Satellite Nebula, or the Skull. I don't really see the skull in it, but anyways. Then the Pleiades and Andromeda. Those are the top four objects that I think you should be looking and trying to find with your longer lens tracking in the night sky, because they are going to be some of the largest and also the easiest to find with your lens. It is not crazy easy to find objects in the night sky, you have to be able to recognize what they look like as an unprocessed file. And with some things, even the Rosette Nebula can be a little bit difficult because it is primarily hydrogen alpha, but it does have a cluster of stars in the middle that are very identifiable, where it's like, oh, I see that cluster of stars. Yes, that looks exactly like the cluster of stars I see in this picture of the Rosette Nebula. It's also very close to Orion, and so it's easy to find it off of Orion. The Pleiades are very easy to see because they have the Seven Sisters, those seven stars that are right there. And you even get to see, when you're tracking, you get to see the wisps coming off, that blue, the lovely blue of the Pleiades that comes off. You don't see the blue in your unprocessed files on your camera, but you can see the actual lighter areas where you'll be able to pull out that blue in post-processing. Andromeda is kind of a fuzzball. But when you get that fuzzball and then you start tracking it, you can actually start to see some of the detail on your camera screen. And so Andromeda can be a little bit more difficult to find because it's a little bit smaller. But when you got it, you know that you have it. And so those are really my top four. So the Orion Nebula, the Rosette Nebula, the Pleiades, and Andromeda. Any of those four are super fun to photograph. I would say start with one and work on that one. This is the type of thing where cumulative nights will make it easier and easier the more that you do it. The process of getting your tracker set up, the process of making sure that you are properly balanced, getting your polar alignment in perfectly, then actually finding the target in the sky. There's a reason why these bigger, more expensive trackers have go-to, where you can just say go here and then it goes to the object for you. And then the process of actually focusing and then getting the right exposure, all of that is not going to happen in the first night that we go out. It's going to take multiple nights of going and shooting and trying. However, it makes it all the sweeter when we actually do get the photos, which is really, really exciting. So that's what I focus on. That's my targets in the night sky in the winter, in the off season. I would be remiss if I did not mention a few other things about shooting under a cold night sky. First up is my cold weather gear. I know I've talked about this in other spots, but this bears repeating. Number one is a lens heater. We need a lens heater to stave off condensation, also sometimes frost, depending where we're at. However, unlike in the summer when I can use one power bank and it'll get me through the night with my lens heater, I need multiple power banks. So they're going to drain much, much more quickly in the cold. I have even, in the past, when it's been really cold, like when it's been freezing, you know, minus 20, minus 25, minus 30 Celsius, when it's been crazy cold, what I have done is had my power bank plugged into my lens heater, but then I've taken hot hands and I have wrapped them around the outside of the power bank with rubber bands to keep the power bank warmer so it doesn't drain as quickly. Even then, it still won't make it through the night, but it helps. So make sure you have multiple power banks. If you're like me and you live somewhere where it's very cold and it gets very cold, like it's not always freezing here. We especially Halifax, Nova Scotia, there's a lot of like where we're so coastal, sometimes it's like plus five, you know, but it's not when it's clear because when it's clear, there is no insulation from the clouds. We are just looking up onto just space and nothingness, just complete freezingness coming towards us from the abyss of space. So it's real cold. It's really, really cold on clear nights. Frigid, as a matter of fact. And I don't like being cold. I am not like Elsa, even though I have watched a lot of Frozen with my daughter over the past couple of days. I am not like Elsa. I don't like the cold. The cold does bother me. It bothers me very much. So I have a few things that are staples for me now. They were definitely a luxury item when I first bought them, and now I cannot believe I lived without them. The first is a heated vest. So I have lots of layers, and I have a big heated vest that I wear underneath my down-filled extra long parka that I have. Actually, it's not real down, but it is a very puffy insulated parka, but it's whatever the fake down is. So I have a heated vest that keeps my core warm and keeps me feeling very toasty. I also have heated socks. So I do use hot hands. I have tons of hot hands all the time. I put them in my shoes anyways, but I also have electric heated socks and I have electric heated mittens. I have the heated mittens because I wear liners, glove liners, fingers with liners, for when I'm actually doing stuff on my gear, but then I have the heated mittens to shove my hands back into and warm up in between. I also always have hot hands with me, always. I just have a big box of them that I leave in my car. My father-in-law is always like, your car is so messy, there's so much stuff in it. And I was like, I need all of this stuff and you leave it alone. Do not try and clean my vehicle. I need all of these things. Hot hands are always just, I have a big box of them in my car at all times. I buy those in bulk at Costco. And ice grippers, very important. Ice grippers that can go onto my shoes because some of the places I'm going to be going, it gets wet near the ocean and it gets real icy. I am quite clumsy and I will fall. So I don't like to do that when I'm carrying, you know, lots of expensive camera gear. So ice grippers are really, really important. Something that I tend to have to purchase every year because one of them always tends to go missing somehow. I don't know how. Those are my biggest things that I have. Now, I do have some other things that I take with me in terms of just because it's winter. So I always have with me an emergency way to contact. So I have a Garmin. I don't always have that as an active subscription, but I do have one of the iPhones that has the SOS mode on it as well. Always having a way to get an emergency contact. This goes back to location scouting and like knowing your location and the place that you're going to in advance. I need to know if the place that I'm going to doesn't have service. I need to figure that out during the day on a daytime location scouting adventure, not at night when there's an emergency and much less likely to run into another person. So I always know for the places that I'm going to be going and shooting at night whether or not I am going to have service where I'm going and making sure that I plan accordingly. I also make sure that I have a phone cord with me. So it gets cold. You know what? Phone batteries die quickly as well. So those multiple power banks that I have, I also have cords to power the things that are on me, like my heated vest, like my phone and other things like that. That power bank's not going to do any good if I don't have a cord to plug it into my phone. I also bring a portable, one of those little, like, what are they called? I want to say rescue blanket, but that's not it. They're the like very thin but reflective blankets that reflect back your body heat. Something happens, I need to be able to stay warm. So I have one of those that I bring with me. I also bring fire starters with me as well. Depending on how far I go, I might also bring a hatchet with me. I do have a portable hatchet that comes with me. It's always in my vehicle. And I might bring it with me depending if I'm going on a farther in hike. If something's going to happen out there, I want to be able to cut down some trees and build a fire if I need to. It's just important to not mess around. You know, if we're going to be going out at night, minus 15, minus 20, minus 30, whatever it is for extended periods of time, It's not like a summer night where it's like, oh, well, I'll just hang out here until the morning and everything will just be fine. Might be a little bit cold. No, like it can be life or death. So we definitely need to make sure to plan accordingly. The other thing with that that goes into location scouting with places that we're going to be shooting at night in the winter is knowing what it's like in these areas in different conditions. So especially here, we get a lot of snow and then it gets warm and then the snow melts and then it gets really, really slushy and wet. And so different roads can be just not passable, you know, when it's freezing and everything is nice and hard and it's easy. And then maybe if we get a bit of a thaw, you just don't necessarily know what the conditions are going to be like, especially in the types of places that I might be going to shoot. So know what the conditions are like in the area that you're going to, and have been to it in different conditions as well. So have been there when there's lots of snow, when there's not lots of snow, when there's runoff, all of the kind of different things. Really knowing the location well and knowing your vehicle well too. There's some places that I just don't get to go to. I have an SUV with four-wheel drive, but I don't have like a big Tacoma truck that can pull and do whatever, you know. I'm not in an awesome Jeep or something like that. So I can go some places, but I can't go everywhere. And that's okay. I have friends with really nice vehicles that can take me places. The other thing as well, in my car, I always have a small portable shovel. If I'm going somewhere and there's been a lot of snow, I'll actually take one of my big snow shovels and shove it in the back of my car. And I always have a bag of sand, sand for grip. So you never know where you're going to go and how icy it might be and where you might be getting stuck. So have the things that you need. There might be other things that you need, like maybe you need to have snow chains for places that you're going to. I tend not to be going anywhere where I'm going to need something like that, but you might. So make sure that you are overprepared. This is not the time of year to be underprepared in any way whatsoever. And if I have not driven this home already, it's just location scout in advance. Know where you're going. Be prepared for the conditions. Obviously, if we're going out shooting, it's probably going to be clear, but that doesn't preclude a snowstorm coming in. Definitely depending on where you live. If you're in a type of mountainous terrain, you'll know how quickly things can change. So make sure that you are prepared in every way necessary. I'm sure there's lots of things that I've missed here depending on where you live, but it's the type of thing to don't take these things. It's not like, I'd probably be fine. I'm just going to hop into my car with just my stuff. Like, unless you're just going on a paved road that's not that far from wherever and you're walking just a couple feet from your car, don't do that. It's just not worth it. The photos are not worth the potential of a life. Now, I will not end on such a positive note. I will instead end on what you should do when you get back home with your gear. This is really important because often we are going to be going from outside, freezing cold, into inside, nice and warm and cozy. And that shift from freezing cold to very warm will create condensation in your camera. Condensation is bad. Say it with me. Condensation, bad. We do not want that. That's the type of thing that grows mold and fungus and that type of stuff in your camera, in your lenses, and is not what we want. So what do? We insulate our gear. The easiest way is just leave it in your bag. So I leave my gear in my bag. I bring my bag in and I just leave my gear in it. And it stays in there until the next morning when I get up. Now, if you are anything like me and you're like, but I want to see my pictures. I know I should just go to sleep when I get home because that's what normal people would do. But I want to see my pictures. then I need you to take your memory card out of your camera before you put your camera into your backpack or your bag and put your stuff into your car. So take your SD cards out first. Or when you get home, go back outside with your gear take your SD card out, then put your gear back in to your backpack and bring it out with you. And I actually should say, often we want to do this in the opposite way as well. If it is safe, you know, my garage is not heated, but it is insulated, so it doesn't get to freezing. It gets basically right at freezing, but it doesn't freeze. I will tend to put my gear in my car before I'm going out shooting. So I'll put the gear in my car. Like, the last thing I would generally be doing with my car that day is picking up my kids from school, get them home, and then I would put my gear into the car so that it can cool down before I'm actually going out and shooting with it. And then the hike of wherever it is that I'm going to shoot at will give it the extra time it needs to cool down. You don't want to be doing the same thing where you've got your camera like sitting on the front seat on the passenger, you know, got your camera strapped in on the passenger seat beside you with the hot air blasting, and then take it right outside into the cold air. The same thing, not good condensation. So we just want to make sure that our gear is insulated when it's either coming up to temp or going down to temp, because it's going to keep from having condensation inside and wrecking our beautiful camera gear. We do not want that to happen. How does this all sound? Are you somewhere where it's cold? And do you now have plans to go out and shoot? Have I sold it? Or are you like, I might just stay inside by the fire with a hot cocoa? Honestly, I will not judge you either way. But anyone who lives somewhere where it's really warm right now, maybe I will judge you just a little teensy, teensy, tiny bit. Maybe just a little bit. I won't judge. No, I don't judge either way. But I will say that you can definitely reap the rewards of getting out and capturing just some really stunning things in the night sky at this time of year. And you know what else it does? It also gets you ready for when it's Milky Way core season again. And the first couple times you're out shooting the Milky Way, it seems so much easier. You're like, oh, this is great. As opposed to when you have not been doing anything for the months of, say, October through to February or March, and you get out to photograph the Milky Way and you're like, oh, I forget everything. What's going on? So that's if the everything else I said has not sold you on it, maybe that will. Thank you for being here with me today. I hope that you have a little bit of inspiration to get out and shoot. And I look forward to talking to you again next time here on After Dark Photography Podcast.